Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for the needlework artist. And for the third time, back with us, Jessica Grimm. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Gary. Nice to be here again.
Good to have you with us. And for those who don't know Jessica, this is her third time as a Fiber Talk Sunday host, so we really appreciate that. Jessica, living in Bavaria, designer, teacher, historian, all of that.
Yes. All those things, yeah.
Yes. So, highly skilled, and if you're ever in Bavaria, look up Jessica. She'd be happy to have you over for a class in her studio, because she does that when we're allowed to get out of our houses. She does that quite regularly.
And at the moment, I do the Skype session, so people can sign up for that as well.
Yeah, that's right. So, that opens some doors internationally. People can connect you at jessicagrimm.com, right? Isn't that what it is?
Yep.
Yes, jessicagrimm.com. That's with two M's. And do a Skype thing. And you have it on your website there, how to do that. So, so anybody who wants to do that, check it out with Jessica, because that would be fun.
It's working really well. You just go onto my website and you search for Learn, which is at the top, and then you find the Skype sessions and just follow the instructions.
Excellent. And that's, is that, well, first let's talk about that for a little bit, but let me get this in first.
Yeah.
And this show is sponsored by Shepherd's Needle, definitely doing online business these days at the Shepherd's Needle. She's got everything there. And when her store's open, she's has classes, seminars, the whole bit. But these days, plenty of online sales, and she has the full gamut of needlework, threads, charts, designs, accessories, you name it. So go visit Ann at shepherdsneedle.com. Thanks to Ann and Shepherd's Needle for sponsoring. Okay, so tell me about this Skype thing. So what exactly are you doing? If I were to call you on Skype, what would I get?
Depending on what you want, you can show me your latest finishes. You can get help with anything you're stuck with, embroidery wise. Basically, any questions you have about medieval embroidery, about gold embroidery, white work, anything.
Okay. So just kind of an open forum, one-on-one, or do you form groups to do this?
No, it's a one-on-one basis, and you book me for half an hour. It is free. I do ask for a donation if you can, or buy something from my webshop if you can. But if you can't, that's absolutely fine. Because many people are in financial distress at the moment.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah, it is. It is really fun. I had somebody 2 hours ago, and it was really, really nice.
Hmm. I may wrangle up Vanna, and we'll give you a call someday.
Yeah, do. Please do.
Yeah. Maybe we just do that. Yep. All right. So the purpose of this show is you've traveled in the past few months. Done quite a bit of travel and done a lot of study of ancient needlework. And I will say to people, if you are not subscribed to Jessica's newsletter, you're missing out. So go do that, because she really does an excellent job and on a consistent basis of sharing her experiences and what she's learned and what she's doing. One of my favorite newsletters by far.
Oh, thank you.
Well, that's just fact. I was most intrigued as you did several articles about your ancient needlework studies, your travels to museums and photos and all that you learned. And on a bigger scale, what interested me was you look at these 12th, 13th, 14th century pieces of needlework art. And I think, all right, that stuff is beautiful. And also, at that time, to pull off what they did amazes me.
Yeah.
But then I start to think, all right, now, how does this relate to today? And then you come back and you try to replicate some of the needlework. And so then I wanted to have a discussion with you about what that needlework is like, what you experience with that, and then how that relates to today and what you experience in replicating it. So talk a little bit about that in general, and then I want to talk about some of these specific things that you saw.
Yeah, sure. The biggest difference with the needlework scene today is that is in the Western world, it's mainly hobbyists doing embroidery. Whereas those pieces that have survived from the Middle Ages were almost all made by professional embroiderers. They were made in a professional environment, in a studio with a master embroiderer and his students. The whole conception of noble women or nuns embroidering these pieces is for the most part wrong. Those pieces have not survived. That is more the exception. And the really nice gold embroidered vestments that you see in museums, they were made by mostly by men in a studio environment. So that is the biggest difference with our type of embroidery. And the other big difference technically.
Jessica, let me back you up on that a little bit. So, do we know that women in the Middle Ages did needlework at that level, or was their needlework pretty much confined to household sewing and embroidery?
Well, this is a very tricky one.
I figured that.
The written sources we have for the Netherlands, and that is what I mainly studied so far. There are no women mentioned.
Okay.
We get the men mentioned with their names, their surnames, where they live, who they are. If a woman is mentioned, she's not mentioned by name, and she's only mentioned as the wife of, and only when it is about a payment after her husband has died. On the other hand, when you go to the guild regulations, women are not specifically excluded. But it seems that these big embroidery jobs, these commissions for the church or for the king, or for high noble men, that is men's business. It might be that it is slightly different in England. We do know of a few female embroiderers. We know them by name. And there might be a few in France and in Cologne. But they are not necessarily mentioned in the documents relating to the commissions. So what I gather from that is that there are two sort of bodies of work. You have the domestic embroidery, and that is probably done by women. And then you have the work in the larger world, and that is done by men. But this is always very unpopular when you say it, especially if you say it as a woman. Every time I write that down in one of my blogs, I get told off. And just for the record, I am a feminist, but I can't change the past. So why get upset about it? And it compares very nicely if you now look to countries like Pakistan, where there's still a large professional embroidery community. That is men, and their women folk do embroider, but they do it at home and they make different items.
Okay, so that stigma very much in place, and now in this hobby flipped over completely. Because it was interesting. You had one in my readings of what you wrote. You had one instance where you referred to an embroidery male who ran, it was his business, but his daughter, I believe it was, seemed like she was an integral part of what he did. And so it made me wonder how many women were working in the shadows, in all those years.
I think that is certainly true, because why wouldn't you? On the other hand, the society was completely different from what we are doing now. I don't know how restrictive things were based on religion, on the fact that men ruled the world and not the women. But you, yeah. during this whole period, from say 500 AD till 1500 AD, sure, there were women embroidering and there were probably women working on these big commissions. It was just not the rule, I think.
Yeah. And certainly don't give them credit.
No.
Well, and that's hard for us to relate today, as much as we still have some of that in our culture. It's very hard for us to relate today to that kind of thinking, especially for instance, you in Germany, where your leader is female, and yeah, we don't that doesn't doesn't make a lot of sense to us these days.
No, but on the other hand, living in Bavaria in a rural environment, I do see the flip side. Here, the women have definitely less opportunities than I, as a, being from the Netherlands, where it's even more feminist and we are even more outspoken as women. It is, I can see a marked difference.
Yeah. So still in
Yeah,
place.
still in place. Yeah.
Keep fighting the battle, Jessica. You can get there.
I know, and it has a lot to do with the fact that here people are deeply, devoutly Catholic. And although the local church, without the women, they can close the doors even before the corona crisis. But still, the women are have a have very little to say in how the place is run. And I think that relates very neatly to the situation of embroiderers in the Middle Ages in this part of the world.
Yeah, that statement is so full of power, especially in churches. Without the women, they just need to close the doors. Because I mean, I'm Lutheran, Missouri Synod Lutheran, stuck in the mud. Martin Luther King, the whole, or Martin Luther, not Martin Luther King, but Martin Luther. That whole thing. And we still have in our Constitution that a woman cannot be chairman of the congregation. It's still very much in place in that way, but boy, I tell you, yeah, you take the women out of the church and it's all over. Absolutely. Cannot happen. Yeah. Yep. So then we look at that, the men running the show, and so all of the commissioned serious embroidery is done by men and run through all these guilds.
There were very strict regulations on what you could use. There was a lot of gold thread going around that was of inferior quality, and if you used it in your embroideries, you could be expelled from the guild.
Okay, so then even back in that time, because I would think you see some of the pieces that you've shown with the gold work, and I just assume that was essentially solid gold.
No.
So there's different levels even then.
The oldest pieces we have, like the that cope, the sterne mantle of Henry II, the Holy Roman Emperor, which dates around AD 1020, that is nearly solid gold. That has a gold content, I think, of 95%, 97%.
Holy smokes.
That is just amazing. It is still so shiny that you think it was made yesterday. But the further you go towards our time, so the younger the pieces are, the gold content is going down.
Oh, I can't even imagine how much gold it took. Oh.
Probably not that much because it is beaten out so thinly
Right,
that
yeah.
the weight is it's still a bit, but it's not kilos. It's hundreds of grams, I think.
Right.
And what they did the gold embroidery, and once the gold was on the cope, they would beat the golden surface. So it gets a more like a mirror-like appearance. It is very difficult to see with the naked eye to see the different gold threads because they're all beaten flat into a united surface. Yeah, they are
Amazing.
spectacular. If you ever in Bamberg, go there. They are UNESCO well, World Cultural Heritage, and they are just
Okay.
amazing.
Well, just the pictures alone just make me stop every time. They absolutely do. Yeah. Now, when I look at the needlework from that time, to me, a lot of instances, it looks fairly crude or elementary in its design. And but I don't know if that's just the way it was then, but is the needlework highly skilled or is it fairly average?
The needlework is both.
Okay.
It is highly skilled because it is very fine. The needlework on the sternum mantle, the gold threads, they are so fine that I had real difficulty to find a modern day equivalent. It is very, very thin passing thread that comes close. But I can see what you mean. The designs, they are rather childlike. And
Yes.
that is because we are before the Renaissance, and people, the whole style of drawing, of sculpture, of anything was not very lifelike. They are more like a cartoon, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So it's all rather simple, and that's just because they are so old.
Okay. And see, this kind of a discussion, I'm way over my skis when it comes to history, especially ancient history. So it's all based on what I see. So I'm going to ask dumb questions the entire time we're here together. But
No, that's brilliant because that makes me think as well.
it pre-Renaissance then, that was just simply the style. Nobody really cared about realism.
No, it's a bit like if you look now in the Eastern Orthodox churches, when they do their icons, it is the same style because everything in at that time came from the Byzantine Empire. That was sort of the most modern folk around. And their style of iconography is what you see in these pieces, and that is relatively simple.
Okay. All right. See, I'm learning. I like it. I like it. It's good.
Good.
All right. Now, you did several pieces on this, and is it epigraphy?
Yeah, I think so. I have no idea how you pronounce it
Okay.
in English, but I think epigraphy,
How do we say it in German then?
Epigraphie.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm going with epigraphy. Thank you. But you went to that conference and it's all about letters and symbols. And then you tried to replicate some of that. And you talked about that thin passing thread. You had quite a struggle finding threads and then threads that would stay together for you.
The biggest challenge was doing a bit of underside couching, which is a characteristic of Opus Anglicanum. Opus Anglicanum it literally means work from England or English embroidery work.
Well, let's stop right there, because that phrase gets used all the time as if everybody knows what it is. So what does that mean work from England, yes, but what does that mean in terms of style and technique?
In terms of style and technique, the style is a bit more like the Byzantine style. So it is definitely pre-Renaissance. So it is a more simpler style, less realistic. And all the embroidery is either done with silks or woolens, but in split stitch
Okay.
for the faces and the hands and the garments. And then the gold work that's in there is all underside couching. So
Okay,
what you
and
do,
what yeah, what is that?
normally when you couch any thread, your couching stitch is on the front of your work. It
Yes.
goes over the thread that's couched down. With underside couching, that couching thread is pulled so strongly that it pulls the thread that you're couching down through the back of your fabric. So
Okay.
You come up in a hole, you go over the thread you want to couch down, and you go down in the same hole you came up in. And when you then give your couching thread a tuck, the thread that you want to couch down dips down through the fabric you're working on.
So we don't see it on the surface then?
No, you don't see the couching thread, no. That is only seen on the back. And what it does to the gold thread that you see on the front is that it has these little dips.
Okay. Because see, when you said underside couching,
yeah,
I was imagining trying to get a needle to go underneath the thread, and I thought there's no way that's efficient at all. You can't get anything done by doing that. So you're just wrapping it over the top and pulling it down and making it bury itself in the thread. I'll be done.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
And so that gives that distinctive look then. Okay. All right.
It does. Yeah. Yeah. And it helps as well because when you're couching thread, which is usually silk for the later periods with the normal couching, when that is on top of your gold threads, and now imagine that the embroidered part with the couched gold threads on it is sort of in the height of the belly of the priest, and the priest is rubbing his belly against the altar because mass is so long and he is getting tired, then you rub off your couching stitches and your gold thread comes undone.
Mm-hmm.
So underside couching is very durable, but it also takes very long to do, and it is rather hard on your hands.
Yeah, because just the physical effort of pulling that thread down.
Yeah.
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 Now, and you were struggling as you tried to replicate this stuff with thread that broke all the time. Is that a function of modern day thread, as best you can tell, or is it just a reality because the thread is so thin?
I think it's a bit of both. It has something to do with the fact that the gold threads we are using today are just different from the ones that they used to use. Then our linen fibers that we have and that go into our linen thread that you use for the underside couching, they are just probably, or what they've told me, they are shorter. So when you spin your thread from these shorter fibers, it is not as strong as it used to be. And then, of course, working through all these layers of fabric I was working through doesn't help either.
Yeah, talk about that some, because I remember you making a statement about how part of it was just the physical effort of getting through so many layers.
Yeah.
And there's and then include the silk, stitching on the silk and then taking the silk away that's not covered.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, what you normally, when you see people recreate underside couching on Instagram or Facebook, they usually only work with their gold threads on linen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's brilliant. Anybody can do that because on linen, even on a higher count linen, there is relatively a lot of space between your fabric threads. But in the medieval times, the linen would be the base layer. Then you would get something like a brocade or a velvet on top. And on top of that, they would put a layer of a tabby silk, just a plain silk, it's a bit different, like a dupioni, but sort of that strong, that sort of thickness. And they would then apply their gold threads and do all their underside couching. And when that was done, they would clip away or cut away the tabby silk fabric.
Why even bother with that silk layer? Why not just do it right on the brocade or the velvet?
Because you can't. If you do it on a velvet, you have all the hairy parts of the velvet sticking up.
Ah, okay.
And that is just, do try it. It is so annoying.
If I want utter frustration, give it a try. Huh?
Yeah. And the other thing is, on a velvet, you cannot count any fabric threads.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
And with this whole the patterns you make with your couching, it is really, really difficult to keep a nice uniform pattern going when you cannot count your fabric threads. So they use the fabric threads of that plain silk to count.
All right.
Not always. There are probably a few masters have been out there that were so consistent in their stitch length that they didn't need it. But then they still need the extra layer of fabric as soon as they were working over a velvet because of the hairy bits.
The hairy bits.
Yeah.
So that whole process that you used, because you're using a prick and pounce,
yeah,
to get your pattern down, and then you used a paint.
Yeah.
I had not seen the paint part.
Oh, that is standard practice when you go to the Royal School of Needlework.
Oh.
Because it is a method that always works. You can do it on any type of fabric, and it is something that is stable. It will not alter with time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you're using things like an aqua trick marker or a friction pen, we don't know what these will do in 50, 60 years' time.
Okay.
So if you use very normal, high-quality water paint, you're fine.
Okay, so and you were using that to trace the outline.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, I'm still not getting, because you're going to stitch over that, so I'm still not getting why the paint.
Well, when you do the prick and pounce, the pounce powder is not stable.
Oh, okay.
As soon as you tap your fabric, it will spread everywhere and it's gone. So you need something to fixate your pounce powder, and that is what the paint is doing.
Okay, so that gives then a piece that I'm going to work on for a long time. Then I don't have to worry about losing my pattern then.
No. Because you could literally not start stitching with only the pounce powder. That just goes in seconds.
Oh, so I see. I've never used pounce powder, so
It is like a talcum.
Uh-huh.
It is I think it's talcum. You call yeah. Talc powder. It is powdery. It's like icing sugar.
Okay.
So just imagine that you have those little dots of icing sugar on your cloth. As soon as you start stitching, it will just spread everywhere.
Okay. All right. I got it now.
Yeah.
I'd put some paint down too. Yes.
Yeah.
But that's just a real thin paint that you're putting down.
Yes. Yeah. You try to paint as thinly as you can. On the other hand, if you don't do it very thinly, you can scrape it off.
Mm-hmm.
So if you leave your paint a little paste-like, you can actually remove it. So it is trying to find the balance between the two, that if you make a mistake, you can still get rid of it.
Okay. All right. So just basically just bend the cloth and it'll flake off if you do it right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay. Or you scratch with your needle very carefully, and it will go.
Just come off. Tell me about one thing that came up. There's so many things that came up in my readings, because there's so much gold work.
Yeah.
But then there's some embroidery, just straight thread embroidery. There's a lot of padding, and you talked about, you showed how you were doing string padding. I was fascinated by that, the mixture of gold work and embroidery. And then when you started doing string padding, you had me. It was just.
Yes, string padding is so nice to do, because it adds this third dimension to things, especially when I like it worked not too high. You can make it rather high. You can do string padding, quite high. But I like to use it just sparingly, and it just gives a nice result, because every time you bend your gold threads, they shine differently.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes these pieces. The trouble is they don't photograph very well. Photographing gold work is very difficult. They become very flat. But if you come face to face with these pieces, there is so much movement in them. And that's why I like to do small videos of them, so that I can move the piece and you see the play of light of it. And it's, they are magnificent. I can so imagine that people were so gobsmacked when a priest in his full regalia came into the church. That must be wonderful. And of course, he wasn't alone. He had his deacons and all the other chaps up there at the altar. And it must be really wow.
Just sparkles everywhere. Yeah, because you don't get that at all in the photos. Yeah, they do look quite flat and rather quite boring, quite frankly.
And I have several here in my studio, and when at night, when it's dark outside, but there's still a bit of light coming from the kitchen, they glow on the walls. They need very, very low levels of lighting, and they are present.
So
It's very interesting.
in a sanctuary with candles, you would have the effect very nicely then.
Oh yes. Oh
Yeah.
yes.
And then, so the, is there, with the gold work then, is there quite a bit of just straight up thread embroidery in between that, or is it a lot of background cloth and the gold work is what dominates and is primarily the stitching?
Well, these
I know it
vestments,
depends. It depends. You're going to say it depends. I
yeah,
know.
it depends. What you usually see on a vestment is that the all the embroidery is done on linen, and they are big appliques, and they go onto these very luxurious brocades and velvets and samites. But the individual pieces of gold work embroidery are rather heavily embroidered. They completely cover the linen. And then the gold work pieces, the linen is cut out and then appliqued onto those brocades and velvets and what have you. So they are very heavily embroidered.
So these pieces then physically get to have some pretty good weight to them then.
Oh, they do. They
Yeah.
do. If you there is a lovely video in one of my blogs where you see a museum, I think he's a museum director, wearing one of these copes, and they found the biggest bloke in the museum to safely transport this cope on his body to the exhibition. And he says that it's incredibly heavy. You couldn't dress yourself. You
Oh.
had to be helped in these things and out of them again.
Incredible. So then we're talking to build to basically build one of these things. We're talking a long time or and or a lot of people involved.
A long time and a lot of people involved and a lot of money involved.
Yes.
Um,
No,
because
no
that
doubt about
that's
that.
yeah, because that is one of the things. We have a very funny relationship to clothing nowadays. Most of our clothing is far too cheap. Whereas back in those days, you only had one set of clothing. And maybe if you were a little more wealthy, you had a second set that you could actually wear on Sunday to church. But also, the church vestments in the church were the most prestigious and the most valued objects that were present. It is not the liturgical objects like a monstrance, the golden big things, the golden candlesticks. They were not as valuable as the vestments. And that is something we nowadays we forget.
Yeah.
And it was normal. No, nobody would flinch when the embroiderer would say, okay, it's going to be that amount of money. They knew.
'Cause it's a long-term investment. I follow a lady, I've mentioned her before, Isabella Pitcher. Prior attires her business in England, and she makes historical clothing, designs it, makes it. And that's in following her, it's amazing to watch what she can accomplish. But also in following her, I've picked up on that sense of you buy a massive dress, or for men, a jacket and pants and shirt, and that's something you use a long time and or hand down, or someone else buys it. Yeah, it's not like today where, hey, I get a hole in my t-shirt, it gets in the trash.
No, it is for life. And partly because the materials were so good. You could actually do that.
Yeah,
Now,
when she builds a dress, you can tell she's not using cheap fabric at all.
no. No.
Yeah. Yeah, it's another culture thing. Yeah. Yeah, and then I was most intrigued. You were at a Paris exhibition.
Oh, yeah.
That looked like it was the most fun.
It was. Yeah, it was very special.
I could tell in your writings there was like an extra little level of enthusiasm there for what you saw.
It was really it was an exhibition on medieval embroidery, and what they very cleverly had done was taking embroideries from different parts in Western Europe. There was a division on Opus Anglicanum. There was a part on Germanic embroideries. There was a part. There were Dutch embroideries. There were French embroideries, and it was just Italian embroideries. And it was really nice to be able to compare the different styles. And that was. And it was just the enormous amount of exhibition pieces there. That was just mind blowing. It was so well put together that I actually went for 2 days in a row.
Now, when you go to an event like this as someone who wants to study the history and then clearly want to replicate some of the techniques and some of the pieces, what is your approach, especially when you have things on display from so many different regions and cultures? What is your approach there? Is it a compare and contrast thing? Are you just being a sponge and just sucking in everything you can get out of it? What are you after when you do that?
I'm a sponge. The first thing you go to do when you go there is very nicely ask if you can take photographs. And most museums nowadays will let you, as long as you don't bring a tripod and you don't use flash. They are completely fine with you taking pictures. They are now no longer scared of you sharing these pictures because they know that it will draw in people. And that's why I always say go there, buy the catalog, because you are helping them. They are underfunded everywhere. And they really need they need people through the door, and they need the sales of catalogs. So I just photograph everything and anything from different angles. Sometimes it's rather difficult because most pieces are kept behind glass, and it is not always very easy to avoid the glare or a seam between two panes of glass. And I already go through an exhibition with the idea that piece or another piece is catching my eye, and I might want to replicate it someday. And then I take extra pictures.
And the catalog, I think that the catalog is an interesting thing. Because anyone can buy those. Usually they're available on their websites, and so that's something that anyone can get, whether you can go or not.
That's why I always mention them in my blog posts. I will always very honestly say if they are good or not so good. But nowadays, printing is so good, and people now better understand what kind of pictures we want. That there's much more detailed pictures in there. They are all in color. It's not like for 20 years when only a few were in color and the rest were still black and white. And they are really good.
Yeah, I remember the days in the magazine business where we would have a meeting to decide which images in the magazine we would print in color. Yeah, because we were limited to four or five in a magazine. All right, well, we can print this one and this one, and then everything else is black and white. Now it's, yeah. The so what, all right, it's the that shift, that transition from what you see there to you say, all right, there's a piece that caught my eye. I think I want to replicate that or take a piece of it and replicate it. Then, and you have one shot to see it at the museum. Then a lot of notes, pictures from different angles, a lot of patients while other people who just want to look pass through? What happens there?
Well, for a starter, I don't take notes.
Okay.
I don't know why. Probably because I'm a dyslexic. So I rather like to look and absorb it all. And one of the things when you get to the stage where I am, where I'm without bragging about myself, but I'm a really good embroiderer, you see these pieces differently. You immediately see how a certain thing was achieved.
Mm.
There are only very few pieces. There are very elaborate, like stump work pieces, but from the medieval period in Austria, and they are highly sculptural. They can be several inches deep. That is something where I can not really see how they are done.
Yeah.
Because that is just a technique we don't use today. I have not been told at the Royal School of Needlework how to do this. There's some paper mache in them. There's a bit of metallic in them just to pat them that high. And there's wood in them and loads of glue. They completely fascinate me, but that is something I am probably not able to replicate from just looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
I would need to go to the museum and ask very nicely if they have a piece that I could see up close and then,
mm-hmm.
probably put it in an X-ray machine or something like it. Yeah.
But for the most part, you've seen and done enough of it
yeah.
that you can
yeah.
look at it and know immediately or relatively yeah. quickly how it was put together.
Yeah. Yeah, because that is one of the other large misconceptions about medieval embroidery. For starters, there's no such thing as cross-stitch.
Okay.
Cross-stitch is a modern invention. I don't know of any cross-stitch pieces surviving from this time period. That's later. We do have surface stitches. We do have a cross stitch, but it is long-armed cross stitch,
mm-hmm.
and that is a beautiful stitch. It creates a very nice braid-like appearance on top. And the other misconception is that medieval embroidery is like surface embroidery, as in it isn't counted. Most of the medieval embroidery is counted thread techniques.
Mm.
All the couching, all the pattern couching is all counter thread technique. And you can do that because it's all worked on the linen.
Mm-hmm.
And you can very clearly see the linen, the fabric threads of the linen, and then do your pattern couching. It is a bit the same with all the what looks like silk shading to us is not as freely silk shaded as we would do it today. It is far more a very measured, almost counter thread technique. It is something in between free surface embroidery and a counter thread technique.
Hmm.
And that is one of the things you only see when you start to study these things.
Mm-hmm. How is it that we aren't doing some of these techniques today? They just fall out of favor or?
I think so. For starters, it's not very easy to get your gold threads.
Yes.
You need to know where to get them.
Mm-hmm.
There are only very few places in Europe that are still producing them. One of the other things we should do now during the crisis, buy gold thread so that I can place large orders when everything is over, so that these companies don't fall over.
Right.
And the other thing, I think we have fallen in love with cross-stitch. Which mm-hmm. is fine. I love cross stitch, but some of these, especially these older copes and chasubles, they are completely stitched in this long arm cross stitch, and they are so spectacular. And they are really all over. There is no background fabric visible, so it's like a heaven and earth design, but then from a 1,000 years ago. and they are so beautiful. And again, this long-armed cross-stitch, they use it in two ways. They use it purely as a counter thread technique, And then they go like, oh, but I need to shape a face and I need to shape hair. Oh, maybe I can actually work it around a curve and fudge a little with it. I think they had we have very strict conceptions about how we use techniques that we some people get very upset when you start mixing things. Or when you use a counter thread technique in a more surface embroidery way. There was no such thing. They were happily experimenting and had not such strong divisions, I think.
It was get the job done and create the art the way you want it to look, regardless of technique.
And one of the things which I find highly liberating, they didn't care about the back of the embroidery.
Oh, my.
Oh, yeah. So, thread running on the back long distances, that is fine. Because they were working in a professional environment, all their embroidery was done on slate frames. So your ground fabric is drum taut and you can have your threads running. It doesn't matter. Because they cannot scrunch up the fabric once you take it off the frame. That is very difficult. If you maintain proper tension, you're fine. You get away with a lot. And they had to because they were in a professional environment and they were constantly thinking, if I go the extra mile, do I get for the time spent, do I get the money? And yeah, you make
It
very
always comes
economic
back to
decisions.
money, doesn't it?
It does. And it is with they happily use knots on the back.
I know you have a picture in there. It's so knotted up, I couldn't believe it.
And they were completely happy about it because a knot will do the job. And just think about it. If I knot very quickly, the knot you have learned, the quilter's knot, that goes so much faster than going through the fabric, make two small pin stitches, and then start stitching. If I make my pin stitches wrong and I'm working with silks, I'm even in danger of pulling out the whole thread and have to start again. So to speed up, every time, because you work on such large panels, every time you just simply make a knot and start stitching, that saves seconds, but working such large pieces, it saves hours. And it didn't matter because these linen pieces were then appliqued onto the other very heavy fabrics, so you wouldn't feel the knots. Impossible. It didn't matter. No. And they were completely happy with knotting away.
And so true, because if I think about all the time that, well, I certainly me, but I'm sure everyone spends anchoring threads. I could make a few hundred more stitches for that time, yes.
Oh yes, yeah. And it doesn't matter when you're working small and you're doing it as a hobby, but as soon as you want to make money with this sort of very slow work, every corner you can cut brings in the pennies. And I say corner cutting, but it doesn't mean that the embroidery is shoddy. It is still of a rather high quality, but it is it is laid out to speed up things.
Make money.
Make money, yeah. And especially the later the gold work orfrays, these gold work appliques, there were several people working on one in different stages. And the customer would pick a background and would pick the appropriate seines that he wanted and the layout. And several people would work on the same piece, and it was just pick and mix. It was really a production line. And you had different qualities. Some are made rather crude and not very nice. I would be very ashamed if I turned any of those out. And then you have a large body of work, which is okay, but not to the highest standard. And the highest standard is relatively rare.
Well, that's the thing, all of that. When the last time I talked to someone from the Royal School, and they were talking about making one of the princesses' dresses and how many people were involved. And that was the thing that I think stuck with me the most, was to have multiple hands involved and maintain a skill level and a quality level. That's a lot of management, and it's also just having a group of people who can stitch at a very high level. But that's tough to do, I would think.
I think it's tougher to do in the Royal School of Needlework environment, where they or not the environment, the type of work they do, because a lot of it is service embroidery. Mm-hmm. So you don't have a hall that is designated where you go down every time. Mm-hmm. Whereas with these gold work embroideries, because they are more or less counter thread techniques, as long as everybody goes down every fourth hole, it will always look the same, unless somebody really pulls really tightly on something. But I think it is easier on these gold work orphreys to maintain consistency. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. They are really made for mass production.
Early factories. Yes.
Oh, yes. Definitely. Yeah.
One of the things that I think was a little creepy to me was in the Paris exhibition, you mentioned about if they would open a grave for any reason, and that there would be embroiderers there with their scissors, and that they would lift the embroidery out of the that just seemed like a little over the top to me.
But it was very common. You see in the 18th and 19th centuries, maybe perhaps a little earlier, you see all these antiquarians, and they are usually people from the upper class. So there's a lot of priests in there and deacons. They start to collect these things. And sure, there are still some laying around in their own parishes where they can just grab them. But then they start to think, where else could these be? And people start to remodel churches. And when they go into the crypt, they find the burials of bishops and cardinals and priests. And when they open them, because they need to be moved, or sometimes things just break down. If you have an earthquake, you might want to restore things. And then they come across these burials where they find the textiles still pretty much intact. And they just get their scissors out and cut out the good pieces.
Oh, jeez.
And they would have whole like friendship albums with these pieces of fabric and embroidery in there, and you would show them to your friends and say, "Oh, look, I'm well learned. Look what I have."
Hmm.
Yeah.
Because see, I was in Europe as many years ago and had an opportunity to go through several churches, and that was one of the things that never leaves your mind. Was I was so surprised at how many, and especially in the bigger churches, how many of priests and bishops were actually buried in the church building. And then I would wonder, and how much all the trappings that would go with something like that, how much is in all those crypts? And now I'm thinking not very much is left.
Probably not. That is also the time when the first archaeological digs were going on. And people would just find out that sometimes textiles are really nicely preserved.
Mm-hmm.
And it has, earlier on, you would get the same things with the saints dying, because you don't die a saint. That usually happens hundreds of years after you are dead.
Right.
And people would then dig up the remains of the now saint and rebury them, or make them into relics. Mm-hmm. And that's when they find textiles as well.
That's disturbing. Just disturbing to me.
But I think what I really liked about the Paris exhibition was that they had several of these pieces on display. And they are not very pretty. They're almost always brownish,
Uh-huh.
Just because of the bodily fluids and the dirt. When somebody is buried with wood and earth and things, they stain the fabric. But it is really nice to see them, because that is a whole different level of embroidery, as it is just different items. It is these liturgical socks and just different types than what usually survives.
Yeah.
But they are equally amazing to look at.
Yeah, because
And they use
you had a couple of pictures that looked like slippers or shoes
Yeah,
and
yeah,
all
yeah.
embroidered, and that was like, that's a lot of trouble for footwear.
Oh yeah, yeah. You wouldn't normally wear them. They were more sort of things you were buried with. Yeah,
Wow.
yeah.
So yeah. So I'd have a drawer. These are my burial clothes.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. People would prepare for the day. Yeah, they had a very different relationship with death than we have now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go
yeah.
to the guild. I need some shoes to wear in my grave.
Yeah. Yeah.
Different approach. Different approach. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, now we're going to run out of time, and I want to make sure that we talk about. You also got to go to the textile place and Auvergne-sur-Oise.
Yes.
Oh, that had to be a treat.
It was, and I must say, Rebecca was really lovely. It is so nice to walk through Paris with somebody who lives there.
Now,
who
this is
studied there.
Rebecca Devani, I assume.
Devani.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And she comes from Ireland, but she studied haute couture embroidery in Paris and worked as an embroiderer in Paris. And nowadays she offers textile tours. And you go to see the haberdasheries of Paris. And she knows quite a lot about the history of the textile, what is it, the textile neighborhoods of Paris. And that is just so fascinating. It's a whole
So she functions as a tour guide. So it isn't just,
yeah.
She's not affiliated with one business. She says,
no.
I will take you to several that I know are interesting. Oh, wow.
Yeah, and she has fostered relationships with the owners of the shops. And that is just wonderful. And especially for us who don't speak French fluently, it is really nice to have a go-between that can do French and English.
Yes, yes. Oh, so I did not grasp that from your writing. So you really got that now that takes on more meaning to me. To be able to have someone who knows what they're looking for and can take you to the best spots and show you the best stuff. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that one shop there where they purchased the millinery and the.
Oh, yeah. That is so nice. That was Ultramod. And that is basically like it would have been in the 18th century, 19th century. It's just frozen in time and still operating.
And you said stuff amazing. That isn't made anymore. So
if you buy it,
that's it.
Yeah. 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 They still sell silks from France, silk and fabric. And that is just there's none produced in France anymore. So if they run out, then it's gone. Yeah. Yeah, and just the walls full of buttons and velvet ribbon and in the most beautiful colors as well, because this was all before the regulations came about certain dye stuffs you can't use anymore because they're poisonous. but they produce rather nice colors.
They'll kill you, but you'll look beautiful going down.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that ribbon shop, holy smokes.
Yeah.
I didn't know they made ribbons like that.
I had come across Makuba before because they are from Japan. And what they basically did, they tried to save the old craftsmanship that was still available in Japan, but was sort of dying out. and they decided we are going to save them, but it needs to pay for itself. We can't just be an NGO. It needs to be to survive. And so they made everything very exclusive. So it is very dangerous to go in there, because all the things that I liked best, you happily pay over $100 for a meter of ribbon.
Oh, jeez. Oh. Yeah.
And I must say, okay, it contained real gold thread.
Yeah.
And things are partly still handmade. And it is of a very, very high quality. And there's everything in there. It is so beautiful. There are thousands of ribbons in there, but it is so well presented that you don't feel overwhelmed. The atmosphere is very calm. You can really well see and compare things, and it is lovely. Yeah.
And to people who are listening, just go to jessicagrimm.com in her blog. And you see all of that. You see all the photos. That's the best way to do it. And then you'll have Jessica's writings around it to really capture what she's talking about. Because even the pictures, when I looked at the picture, I thought there's no way that these can match what you saw in person.
No. Yeah. You literally can't photograph, especially in ultramod. These are old shops. They are dark, and they had to be dark because you don't want to have your textiles bleaching out because of sunlight.
Right.
But it makes it very difficult for us to photograph and to really relay what I saw there. And it's just, yeah, if you are ever in Paris after this whole Corona thing is over, it is well worth to do a tour with Rebecca. Yeah, or to seek out the shops yourself, because they are open to the regular public.
Yeah.
You're probably not getting. Oh, sorry.
No, the Auvergne sale room.
Oh yeah, yeah. That is something that is not open to the public.
No?
It is. I think it is open to the public once a month.
Mm-hmm.
But Rebecca makes sure you have exclusive access and you can just buy.
I like Rebecca.
Oh, me too. That's it must have been really difficult to gain the trust of people so that you can set up these things.
Yeah.
Because it is sort of cross-cultural between Irish, English, and then the French. And,
right.
Yeah, but she's done a really good job. Yeah, really nice. And Auvergne Soie, that is just, silks. What else do you want?
that's got to be an incredible rainbow that you just stops you at the door. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and very friendly people as well. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so that shop opened to the public once a month, but generally a wholesale shop or a wholesale business then?
Yes. Yeah, you can get your Auvergne Soie. I think in America it's imported by Access Commodities, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Normally you get it through your LNS or online, but they mainly do wholesale.
Okay, and then the last question, in all these trips, how much stuff comes home with you other than pictures? Or are you very controlled and disciplined?
I'm very controlled and disciplined. That is because I already have a large stash.
Oh, okay.
So I can be nowadays. And because I've now so specialized on the gold work embroideries and the silk embroideries, it's very particular things I want.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the stuff I can't get from the haberdasheries of Paris.
Okay.
They really come from even more exclusive places where I get my stuff. Yeah. Unfortunately.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So your suitcases are essentially the same content as you left. Okay.
Yeah. I did buy a bit at Auvergne Soie. I did find some real stone beads in the drogerie. And of course, I took books from the museums. That is my downfall.
That's where the willpower just disappears, huh?
Oh yeah, yeah, and as said, I like to support the museums as much as possible. I even go so far that I have my coffee and my cake at a museum when they offer it, even if it's rubbish, because I know that they make the most money on that sort of things. That is a very easy way to support them.
Yeah, help them where you can. Jessica, as always, an absolute treat to talk with you. Thanks so much for the
Thank
time.
you so much. Yeah, you're welcome.
Learn stuff every time from you. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to Shepherd's Needle for sponsoring shepherdsneedle.com. Go make Anne work. Thanks. Bye.